Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we are going to be digging into some fun topics tonight, brought to us in part by a question from a listener out there. So that's exciting. We'll be getting into that in just a second here, but we can't do anything at all. And I mean that because she is the glue that holds this show together, Sam Bradley. Hey, Sam, how you doing?
Hey, Jamie. Well, I'm just glad I finally got connected on Skype. I was having weirdness going on in my computer.
Yeah, the Skype gods are finicky sometimes.
They did it again. But it's actually raining here, and I'll admit, I haven't seen rain in a while. It's been snow for so long, so that's kind of interesting. We don't have meteorologists tonight, but there are a few things going on out there, like an 8.1 earthquake in New Zealand. Haven't heard a lot about that yet, but I know they had concerns with tsunamis in American Samoa and even Hawaii, and I guess they've standing down from that. So that's a good thing. But I was sitting here watching the AccuWeather channel, and they mentioned there could be tornadoes spewing about next week from the south, not quite into the east, but kind of moving up that way. So we could have some interesting weather next week. Anyway, but it's interesting because all of that kind of segues into our guest tonight. And you're right, Jamie, the question did come from one of our community, Heather Howell. And she's actually a high school teacher in Ontario and teaches an e-learning natural disasters course, which I thought was terribly interesting. But she was mentioning an EF3 tornado that occurred in January in Canada, and it pretty much shocked them because that generally doesn't happen. So it kind of put her on the weather's getting kind of weird thing. But another piece of that is she asked about FEMA funding and climate change influenced natural disasters and so forth. And we kind of bandied that about because we don't get into the politics too much on this. But Becky came up and said, oh, I know somebody who's quite an expert in that area. So we brought her on tonight, Samantha Montano. And she does a lot of stuff. She's got the greatest website, Jamie. So we'll have to
Get that link so I can put it in the show notes for the episode then.
Yeah, I was very impressed with that. In fact, I wasted half the morning. But she's a PhD in emergency preparedness, an assistant professor in Massachusetts at the Maritime Academy. And what else would you like us to know about you, Samantha?
Well, thanks for that introduction. Yes, I have my doctorate in emergency management. I've been doing disaster-related work for over a decade now. I got started in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. I do a lot of different research related to how we respond to disasters. I teach emergency management classes, and I also do a lot of kind of public engagement and science communication work to try and share emergency management research with the public.
Excellent. Well, we got Dr. Joe Holly with us tonight. He is a FEMA USAR employee. I am a DMAT employee under NDMS, so we'd be very interested in what you have to say about all of this and the FEMA funding and so forth. So we talked about some questions this afternoon, and boy, there's some good ones. So I'm going to start chunking through that list. Climate change. Now, not everybody believes in that, but for the sake of argument, we're going to assume at this moment that it does. So give us a little crash course in how climate change, extreme weather, and emergency management are related. I thought that was a great question.
Sure. So obviously in emergency management, we deal with a lot of different natural hazards, everything from hurricanes to river flooding to winter weather, heat waves, all of these hazards that are related to the climate in various ways. As we have begun to see around the country, as the climate begins to change, many of these hazards have begun to change. So, you know, we see that hurricanes are getting stronger. We're seeing differences in rapid intensification. Some of those, you know, characteristics of those hazards are changing. And on the one hand, that can seem like maybe not that huge of a deal for emergency management because, of course, we've, you know, had to manage these various hazards, you know, forever. And so in that sense, we kind of have a good grasp of, you know, how we need to go about dealing with these events. But because of the way these hazards are changing and how they're affecting different places differently, we actually are seeing that emergency management is needing to shift how we do things. So part of this is connected to how we respond and our capacity to respond as we've started to see an increase in risk, an increase in disasters happening around the country. We have started to see some strain on our kind of emergency management system as a whole. I like to use the 2017 hurricane season as an example. You know, we had Harvey, Irma, and Maria all, you know, in quick succession. And we saw that kind of by the time we got to Maria, even, you know, part of our formal system, even within FEMA, was strained in trying to meet all of those needs. It also affects recovery. We have places like Houston, for example, that are experiencing these flood events with increased regularity and to an increasing level of destruction. And very often we're seeing communities that kind of get stuck in this cycle of recovery where they can't recover before the next disaster comes. And then this also affects mitigation and preparedness as well. Mitigation, maybe especially in terms of, you know, what we need to be doing and kind of the urgency that we have to mitigate our risk to these various types of hazards. So, you know, climate change is, of course, not the only factor that is contributing to our risk. Other things like where we develop and, you know, policy decisions that are made about where and how people live are obviously important factors at play, too. But climate change is certainly a major factor there.
Well, Becky slid in the back door. Hi, Bex.
Yeah.
Somehow I swear I read that you weren't able to be here tonight, but we're glad you are.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one.
Well, yeah, I know you wanted to be here for this one. So, you know, just real quickly, diverting back to the weather, it sounds like it's going to be pretty dicey next week in a certain section of the country, eh?
Oh, a lot of the country. Unfortunately, after a calmer week this week, we're headed back into a pretty active pattern. So could be snow, severe weather. It's really that time of the year when we start to see a pretty active system and pretty volatile systems. So, we're headed into severe weather season for sure.
Well, there was also something I was watching, AccuWeather, by the way, that said that there's some potential for tornadoes in that system.
There is. There's a couple of different chances next week, middle and end of next week, right in the middle of the country. So Texas, Oklahoma, maybe Kansas, into the sort of central part of the U.S. So if you're in that area, now is the time to brush up on your severe weather plan. Make sure you have a way to receive warnings, most importantly.
So would Dr. Joe be in the middle of that like he has been so many lately?
Not at this time. It looks like it'll mostly stay west, but I don't know, knowing his luck lately.
Well, yeah, you know, he says he's traveling, but we don't know what he's traveling into, right, Joe?
That's right.
We never know quite where you are or where you're going, so it's kind of a crapshoot. But Tennessee has taken a pretty good hit this year, hasn't it?
Yeah, we've had more than our fair share of unusual and unwanted weather.
Well, the thing is, and I'm bouncing from the list of questions here, Samantha, but, you know, the weird thing is, and it directly relates to the question that Jamie got, was, hey, why are we having an EF3 tornado at this time of year in Canada? Because that doesn't usually happen. You know, and you mentioned hurricanes are getting stronger and all of that. I don't know enough about New Zealand to know if an 8.1 earthquake is something bizarre or not, but that's what seems to be happening. So I would assume that disaster preparedness people, where it used to be, well, California only worries about wildfire and earthquakes, and Colorado worries about snowstorms and tornadoes. Now you don't know what you're going to get. Becky, wasn't there another earthquake somewhere in our country where we don't usually have one? I remember seeing
How recently?
Oh, God, I know I saw something. I'll have to.
I mean, there's been a fair amount of earthquakes in, like, Oklahoma lately.
Yeah, that's where it was. That's where it was.
Yeah.
So you just, you know, that's stretching the concept of preparedness, because you prepare for stuff you don't expect to see. Right, Samantha?
Yeah, definitely. So I think, you know, there are places, I think New Zealand is, you know, a place that is pretty used to having earthquakes. But, you know, one thing that I would point out is as some hazards begin to change, it puts a strain on the emergency management system as a whole, right? We use relatively the same, you know, people and resources and organizations and agencies to respond to an earthquake as we do to a hurricane, as to a tornado or river flooding. And so, especially for like our national disaster nonprofits, for example, you know, if there is an earthquake on one side of the country and a hurricane on the other and river flooding in the middle, that's going to, you know, strain the capacity of those organizations to be able to meet all of those needs across the country. So, you know, even hazards that aren't necessarily directly related to climate change, I think there's a cause to be more concerned about our ability to respond to those types of events. And to your point, it, you know, indicates that we need to be doing even more to prepare as we move forward and anticipate these changing hazards.
Well, Dr. Joe ought to know about that. Joe, how many times have you been in a situation where there's been multiple incidents going on across the country that might call for USAR resources, and you have to basically triage all that out?
Yeah, it happens surprisingly often, and has become obviously much more complicated with the pandemic, which often leads to an incident within an incident in many cases. But, you know, I think the other key point here is with the effects of climate change and broader, more rapid, more extreme changes in the weather over shorter periods of time. As was mentioned earlier, you know, we don't have as much time to recover and reset and be ready to go again. And to me, it says a lot about we need to be changing our focus toward much more preventative strategies than we've been using in the past, because we're quickly falling farther and farther behind in our ability to get ourselves ready for the next one.
Well, of course, you and I were going on one response to another, back to back to back during 2017, during Harvey and all of that, because these storms just kept coming. And that's kind of a good example of that. But do you feel that, having been back to some of those areas since, are they better prepared since the last one?
I think the answer is variable. I see improvements in the people side of things. They seem a bit more organized. They're more structured and that sort of stuff. I don't see big changes in infrastructure and depth of resiliency, but obviously those things often take a long time to put in place. I mean, those are pretty long-term investments.
Yeah, that's true. It costs money, unfortunately. Samantha, you mentioned having gotten interested in what you do from Katrina, so you studied that pretty well. Do you sense that New Orleans is much more prepared for the next one that may very well happen?
Well, my answer is in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. To your point, recovery takes a really long time. It takes much longer than I think a lot of people realize who haven't had to go through it or haven't worked recoveries. We're talking about, for an event the size of Katrina and the Levee failure, a decade plus long recovery. There are still people even today within the city of New Orleans who don't feel like they've recovered, who haven't necessarily rebuilt their house yet. And so I think when we think about the next hurricane that will affect New Orleans, you have to look at kind of individual preparedness. And in that sense, I think there is a greater awareness and urgency among some people in terms of things like evacuation, right? Needing or understanding the need to evacuate when those orders are issued. Partnership with that, greater efforts from the city to make sure that public transportation is available for people who need it so that anybody who wants to leave can leave. That said, there are certainly many changes have been made to the flood control infrastructure around New Orleans and in New Orleans. We do also see, though, that, a bad rainstorm coming through New Orleans and the streets fill with water, the pumping system becomes overwhelmed. When we think about kind of how ready they are, it really depends on the hurricane. It depends on the direction it hits the city. It depends on if all the pumps are working. There's a lot of different factors that are playing into that. Whether there's enough warning to actually issue evacuation orders. One thing that we saw this past hurricane season is rapid intensification of these storms. That's a huge concern from an emergency management perspective in terms of, understanding if the risk is big enough to order a mass evacuation. Those decisions are not made lightly and are really complicated. So to answer your question, yes, in some ways, I think New Orleans is better prepared for some hurricane situations, but in other ways, not necessarily as prepared as we would like.
Well, it takes me back to my very first deployment when I was working with Red Cross, and Hurricane Juan, what was it, 1985, something like that, came in at the south end of Louisiana. And the bizarre thing about it was it came in, then went back out, and gained strength and came back in again, and the levees couldn't handle it, and kind of the same thing happened. That was quite bizarre. And I remember caskets floating all over the place, and it's another weird story. But anyway, Jamie, thoughts?
Well, I think that, the challenge here is, as Samantha alluded to and Joe mentioned as well, is the individuals, the people involved, maybe gain some knowledge, some experience, and build upon their personal resiliency and maybe their organizational resiliency. But the infrastructure of the overall community, it takes time to change, and that's if change is actually something that is wanted or pushed for. And so I would wonder, what kind of initiatives are there, if any, out there that are trying to push for infrastructure upgrades and changes in some of these places that are getting hit again and again and again. I think of, parts of coastal North Carolina, that have been hit by multiple hurricanes year after year, the Houston area and the Texas coast in recent years. I'm just curious, is there anything that helps to build that resilience on an infrastructure and community level?
Yeah. You know, in communities across the country, there are a lot of different community advocacy groups that operate primarily at a local level that are advocating for changes to infrastructure, kind of mitigation more broadly for their communities. We see, you know, some groups in Houston have been extremely active in the past few years, given the frequency of flooding there. They've really zeroed in on development decisions in Houston, and then also advocating for changes to flood infrastructure in Houston. Again, we see a lot of kitchen table community activist groups that, where a neighborhood is flooding repeatedly. And so the homeowners come together and start, going to their town hall meetings and advocating with their local government for changes to their infrastructure and to increase their hazard mitigation efforts. So there definitely are across the country a ton of these types of groups that are doing this work. Unfortunately, a lot of them face a fair amount of opposition, or at least face many challenges in being able to make a lot of progress on these mitigation efforts. A lot of the mitigation that needs to be done across the country is really expensive. We're talking about millions and millions of dollars, and a lot of local communities don't have that kind of money laying around. And so, groups are having to kind of navigate their way through some pretty complex state and federal programs to try and get grant money to do those projects. Also, mitigation tends to be a fairly technical process, so you may have to bring in various types of scientists and other technical experts, engineers, to help with that work. It also is not necessarily always a politically popular policy area. Even if you have a strong case for why maintaining a levee or building a levee for your community is a good idea in the long run, for many politicians, it's kind of a big expense up front, and they probably won't still be in office when that disaster actually happens. And so actually convincing them that this is something they should spend their political capital on is very often a challenge.
That's an interesting point. It's kind of what you're speaking to here, but one of your points was that, the hazards are becoming more frequent, they're stronger, they're otherwise different, and it's changing our risk. I mean, are emergency managers getting that, or are they just, the comment you just made would fall into that? Are they going to put their head in the sand and wait for somebody else to fix it?
As with any issue in emergency management, I think you can find various approaches. I will say that, FEMA includes climate change. They specifically include climate adaptation in the National Mitigation Framework. So climate change itself is integrated into some of FEMA's main policies. We do also see at a state and local level in many places around the country, climate change is included within hazard assessments that emergency managers are doing. In many places, and I think especially places that are already feeling the effects of climate change, I think emergency managers are very much aware of why this is an issue for them, and are already kind of starting to have this experience of being on the front lines of climate change. Again, though, to your point, obviously climate change can be a politically toxic topic in some communities and some places. And so certainly we do see some emergency managers kind of try to shy away from using that terminology or try to approach it from a different angle. There's variation across the country, but from an emergency management perspective and, you know, from the perspective of a local emergency management agency, everything that we're doing is supposed to be risk driven, right? We're supposed to be, you know, making decisions based on hazard assessments, based on risk assessments. And I think to the extent that emergency managers are doing that and doing that well, then, you know, climate change will be an issue for, you know, every agency across the country.
Well, I would think it would be hard to do a hazard assessment when all these weird things happen that you wouldn't have factored in. And, you know, emergency managers, unlike politicians, they have their jobs for a while. And I think there is some dedication to their communities. And, you know, hopefully they'll be able to do their job, the jobs that they see that they need to do. Bex, you got to have a burning question or a thought over there.
Yeah, so I was thinking about how much the population has increased along the coasts. You know, we just went through another census, so I imagine we'll see some more data coming out, you know, in the next year or two on how the population has changed. And it just seems like as we're seeing more and more impacts to coastal communities because of climate change, how is that something that emergency managers can work I don't even know how to ask this, to be honest, but we know the population at the coast is increasing at the same time that threats to the coast is also increasing. How do you cope with that as an emergency manager?
It's hard. It's literally a recipe for disaster, right? You're putting more people and more things right in the path of where we know where we have an increasing hazard risk. And so it's really hard. And look, emergency managers are amazing. They move mountains all the time. They're not going to be able to address climate change on their own, right? They are very often the people that kind of get called in when the disaster happens and are kind of yelled at to clean up the mess. And that, I think, is going to be an increasingly difficult position for a lot of emergency managers to be in. When we think about, you know, from an emergency management perspective, kind of historically, I think there's been a lot of focus on mitigation in terms of, you know, building a levee, implementing building codes, kind of those more traditional and tangible mitigation efforts. But I think that as we move forward and we see this ballooning risk, especially in coastal areas, I think that there is the possibility and probably a high likelihood of emergency managers needing to move into a more explicit policy positioning to talk about, you know, serious policy changes about how and where people are living, and to really kind of be at the forefront of driving conversations about what a community is going to look like 5, 10, 15 years down the road. I mean, especially in these, you know, communities that are right along the coast that are already experiencing sea level rise, there are many communities, many neighborhoods that are already, have already moved or are in the process of moving inland. And again, this is something where emergency management is on the front lines. They're helping with grants for these kinds of programs. And they are kind of increasingly becoming involved in these really difficult and complex policy areas. So, you know, these are, you know, really hard conversations to have. There's no kind of one answer fits all. Every community is different. But certainly as we move forward, emergency management will be at the forefront.
I agree. And, you know, there's the salient pieces of dealing with disaster are preparedness, response, mitigation, recovery. And I would hope, I mean, that's a lot for somebody's plate. And I'm getting the sense that not all emergency managers, as well-intended as they may be, get the support from the community in terms of finances or politics or whatever else to do what they need to do. And I think any number of you have mentioned it, you know, preparedness is a big thing. I think enough has happened this last year even that people can't sit back and say, oh, that'll never happen here. So I'm hoping that they are learning how to do their personal preparedness plans for whatever may come.
Yeah, certainly. Individual and household preparedness is certainly a must. I'd also add that, as we think about this increased risk in the future, I think we also want to be taking a really kind of broad perspective of preparedness and thinking, not only about individual preparedness, but also community preparedness. Be thinking about what does it mean to kind of build capacity, to your point, within our emergency management system. You know, you're right, one emergency manager is not going to be able to do all four phases as we kind of deal with this increasing risk in the future. And so thinking about, what other positions need to be hired within an emergency management agency, this kind of traditional model of having a part-time emergency manager who's doubling as the fire chief probably isn't going to work moving forward as this risk increases.
I couldn't even imagine. Couldn't even imagine, even in a small community. But mm-hmm. How does FEMA decide and give help and funding to local communities for those things, hazard mitigation, climate adaptation projects, preparedness, all of that?
Yeah, so there are some existing mitigation like grant programs that communities can become eligible for. So generally what happens is a community puts together a mitigation plan for their community where they've identified their hazards, identified their risks, and usually they identify a couple different projects that are a priority for their community. So maybe they'll have a neighborhood that needs to be bought out, or a levee that needs some additional funding to maintain or whatnot. They'll put together those projects and they'll start working with FEMA and the state level agencies to kind of figure out where they can find funding for those types of projects. Sometimes that funding is coming from like the Corps of Engineers. Sometimes it's coming from FEMA. Sometimes they're finding money through HUD and some recovery programs. Sometimes the state has some available funding. So it's kind of a complex web of mitigation grant funding that they can go through to try and kind of pull those dollars together. I will say that those grant programs are very often frustrating for local communities to go through. There's kind of a lot of red tape. It takes a long time and is not always the most intuitive process. And also there's not always enough mitigation funding for certain communities, other communities. A new report came out in the past couple of weeks that found some communities hadn't used all of the mitigation money that had been made available to them by FEMA because they couldn't meet the local match in dollars to do those projects. So it's, again, a kind of complicated mix of programs that are going on there. But FEMA does have this pool of money that communities can draw on for hazard mitigation and climate adaptation projects.
You're right. It sounds very complicated. What do you think, Joe? Any final thoughts?
Well, with all things governmental, obtaining those grants, loans, et cetera, often are quite complicated, and you need help just to work your way through the system to be able to get access to that stuff, which I think, it's the right thing to do, but it's also a deterrent to a lot of folks to try to pursue that.
Well, what we do know is if people need rescuing, Joe and his team will be there. That's the bottom line. Miss Becky, final thoughts?
I guess I would just have one more question for Sam. If you, I love your Twitter. You have so many just so well-worded opinions and facts and your wealth of knowledge. But if you had to choose one thing, this may be a terrible question. If you had to choose one thing that you wanted people to know and understand about emergency management or disasters, what would it be?
Oh gosh, one thing. well, I think that I think the kind of the most broad thing here is that disasters are not inevitable, right? Certain hazards may be inevitable, right? We're always going to have hurricanes. We'll always have tornadoes. We'll always have earthquakes. But the amount of destruction that they cause is not inevitable. There are things that we can do, whether it's, you know, changing building codes, doing buyout programs, thinking through economic and social vulnerability, that can dramatically lessen the suffering that comes with disasters, and that, you know, many of those things that we could do to minimize that suffering aren't really that complicated or aren't necessarily that difficult to do. It's a matter of kind of coming together and really dedicating time and resources to making those changes.
That's beautiful. So, Jamie, what are your thoughts?
Well, I love having these discussions, and I want to thank the listener that sent us the idea for this topic, and of course Becky and Samantha for putting together the idea to come on the show. We appreciate your time and energy to share your thoughts with us. So that's all super valuable. But one of the things I think that, you know, it comes down to is, you know, preparedness is always related back to training and those kind of things for the responders, for the emergency planners and disaster managers that are on the ground in different areas. And that always brings us back to Joe and the things that you guys do at Paragon Medical Education Group. You sponsor this program so that we can get it out there and get this information available for the listeners, both in the United States and around the world. And the cool thing is, Joe, you guys provide the training and the experiential resources for people in the United States and around the world. And I think that's something that folks may not know, is that you can go just about anywhere.
We can indeed. We've been a lot of places, and so that makes it easier for us to go many places. And we always look forward to talking to folks so we can plan exactly what it is they need as far as training is concerned.
Where can they find you, and what's the best way to reach out to you?
They can always find us at ParagonMedicalGroup.com or on our Facebook page at Paragon Medical Group, or through the Disaster Podcast or the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
Excellent. And thanks again for your continued support to bring the Disaster Podcast to folks every week. Samantha, thanks again for coming on the show. Becky mentioned your phenomenal Twitter feed. Would you like to share with us how folks can get access to that?
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter. It's Sam L. Montano. You can also find my website as www.disaster-ology.com.
And I understand you have a book coming out soon. Is that correct?
I do. So my first book is coming out at the beginning of August. It's called Disasterology, Dispatches from the Frontlines of the Climate Crisis. And you can pre-order it now if you're interested.
Excellent. And I'll have a link to that so that we can make sure folks get access to it and pre-order it now so they can make sure that they have it available as soon as it gets released. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Becky, where can folks find you?
Over on Twitter at WX_Bex, Disaster Podcast Facebook group. And I just want to plug Sam's newsletter called Disasterology. You can get it in your inbox once a month-ish. And let me just tell you, it's a deep dive, and it will send you into a rabbit hole of just reading all the things. But I'm going to throw a link for that into the chat, and I highly recommend subscribing to it.
Excellent. We'll definitely include that in the show notes too. Thank you. Sam Bradley, where can folks find you?
Well, probably reading that newsletter. I actually ran across that today. Her website is fascinating. I spent way too much time on there today. She's got all kinds of things going, a blog and a newsletter, and good info. for disaster junkies like us. But you can find me in all the aforementioned places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and certainly in the Facebook group for Disaster Podcast. Jamie?
And, of course, you can all find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations. Please friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. And, of course, in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group and over at disasterpodcast.com. And don't forget, while you're over at disasterpodcast.com, you're looking at each individual episode page, you can subscribe to the show using your favorite mobile device. So make sure you do that. You can sign up for iOS, Android, even by email if you want, and that way you won't miss any of our upcoming episodes. So it's important to catch that. Good episode, Sam. I'm so glad we got Samantha on the show, and we're going to make sure we link to her resources both here and over in our Facebook group.
Exactly. And I thank Bex for shooting us over to where we could find her. So I think the thing about this show is emergency managers and meteorologists are your friends, so be nice to them.